Dr. Gass came to UBC in 1974 when the zoology department advertised for a good teacher. He had been a high school biology teacher, and he had attended a biology teachers institute in Oregon, where he had been asked to stay on as the assistant director of the program. During that year, he had conducted his PhD research on hummingbird behavior and ecology. At UBC, he continued to conduct research on hummingbirds, sought graduate students, wrote papers, and was consistently awarded the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council funds. In 1995, Dr. Gass was proud to be selected by Reform MP Randy White as one of the very worst wasters of Canadian taxpayers' money. That award and the responses it generated focused intense national attention on the importance of fundamental research. But 2 years ago, Dr. Gass decided not to continue with his research. He closed down his laboratory and he turned his efforts full-time to what he was really good at, teaching and faculty development. He was one of the group that invented UBC's innovative Science One program, and he taught in that program for its first 3 years. He has also taught in the Integrated Sciences degree program since its inception, and in the Coordinated Sciences program, and participated in the Science First lecture program for undergraduates. He has been in demand by many universities around the world to demonstrate how these innovative programs can be developed. In 1999, UBC awarded him the Killam Teaching Prize and the National 3M Teaching Fellowship. He was the Case CCAE Canadian Professor of the Year for 2002. And in the autumn of 2002, he was also the first distinguished visiting teacher professor at Guelph University. So join with me in welcoming Dr. Lee Gass.
Thank you. It's really, really nice to see so many people here on a dark and stormy Saturday night to think and talk about education. It reminds me of the first time I went to Singapore in 1996. I was supposed to give a talk for faculty, and it was on a Saturday. There were about 250 people in the room, and they introduced me, and I stood up, and I looked out at all these professors on a Saturday, who were there to think about education, and I just started to laugh. And when I got control of myself, I said, this is amazing that so many professors in a research university would give up a Saturday to come think about education. Did somebody make you come? And they all just roared. They just roared, and one person in the room turned maroon, who was an associate provost or something, and everybody looked at him, and I knew. But the thing that I said was that would never happen in my university. As recently as 1996, I couldn't imagine that many professors gathering to think about education. Today, things are different. And the main thing that I want to talk about today is the change in the institution that has made it possible for more and more and more people to think about education, not just as something that we have to do, but something that we can do and do well, and to do as members of a community. Before I do that, though, I want to do what professors do and what professors like to do, which is profess. And so I'm going to do a little professor thing with you for just a few minutes. It's something I realized when I was in the shower tonight. Human beings are a very, very social species. We live in groups, and we've always lived in groups for as long, far back as anybody knows. We've lived in groups. And And when I think about the way most of us were educated, we were educated in a way that didn't really take advantage of that sociality. We're very competitive. We probably, for a couple million years, we've competed for mates, we've competed for food, we've competed for good places, good safe places to sleep. We've competed for all kinds of things. But we've also cooperated. And it just really struck me tonight how different things are here and have become more and more different over the last 10 years because we've been moving more and more toward a cooperative way of thinking about educating ourselves and educating students. And so really what I want to focus on, if focus is a word that can be used for this, is the community aspect of what's happening. And in order to do that, I need to go back. Dr. Marshak said that I was a graduate student at the University of Oregon. And in the early spring of 1974, my department head and my PhD supervisor called me in and said, "Lee, we love you. You're teaching all of our courses for us. You're doing us a wonderful service. But we've called you in here to tell you that we won't be paying you anymore after this year. And if you want your two little kids to have anything to eat, you'll just have to go out and get a job." And I said, "But I need more data." And they said, "You may very well need more data. And you can stay here as long as you like. And you can continue to teach all our courses for us. We're just not going to pay you anymore." And so I had to do something that I hadn't done yet, which was realize that I was going to have to get a job. As far as I was concerned, staying there, playing with hummingbirds, playing with students, was something that I would have been content to do forever. And so I had to get a job. And I didn't know how to get jobs, so I asked my graduate student friends, "How do you get jobs?" And they said, "Well, you look in the back of Science Magazine, you idiot. That's how you get jobs. There are ads back there." So I looked, and there were 5 jobs in Western North America that I could apply for, 3 in Colorado, 1 at University of Washington, and 1 at University of British Columbia. And I went to Peter Frank, an ecologist, and in a sense a mentor of mine, and I said, "Well, Dr. Frank, do you know anything about the University of British Columbia?" And he said, "Oh my God, is there a job there?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you'd never be able to get a job there. And if you did, you wouldn't be able to keep it." Now, Peter is a very helpful person, and he's one of the most pessimistic people I've ever met. The three universities in Colorado didn't even respond to my letters. University of Washington invited me for a seminar, but they whispered in my ear that they had tailored the job ad for the person who had developed the theory that I was testing in my thesis work. And Tom Shainer did take that job. And I came here. And it's true, the Department of Zoology, for some reason, as far as I know, it hasn't been repeated in the history of the universe, but they advertised for a teacher. And I've been saying they advertised for someone dumb enough to want to teach all their first year courses for them. And that was me. I love doing that. But I need to tell you about the night that I heard Peter Larkin, my department head, offer me the job on the telephone, 11 o'clock at night. I got home. Joanne said, "Call Dr. Larkin. I think he wants to offer you the job." So he offered me the job, and then here's what he said. He said, "We're hiring you on your teaching, but we'll damn well fire you on your research. And don't you forget that." So that was the atmosphere that I entered. It was an atmosphere of very, very strong commitment to research. And the commitment to teaching was different because each of us was individual. We had a relationship with our own students. We rarely talked about education with each other. We didn't really know how to talk about education anyway, because we didn't have the language for talking about it. And that's more or less the way it continued. Interesting things happened in my class and in other people's classes with students. And I just want to tell you one story about something that happened in the first year of my teaching, first year biology, before I zip forward to when we got a new dean of science, Barry McBride, but that'll be in about 5 minutes. This was in the spring of the year, right about now, right before final exams, the spring of 1975, and I was working in my office in Hut B6, trying to write a paper. And the way I tried to write papers in those days was I scribbled on a piece of paper, and then I wadded up the piece of paper and threw it in the wastebasket, and then I scribbled on a piece of paper and wadded it up. And I spent the afternoon making this horrible big pile of efforts. And then my stomach started to growl, and I started getting hungry. But in the meantime, I was aware of two people sitting on the front porch of Hut B6. I couldn't really see them very clearly, but I could see these two colored shapes out there. It was that crinkly bathroom glass that you can't really see images through. And the window was open, so I could tell it was two young women talking, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. And so I got too hungry and decided to go home, and I got my motorcycle helmet and my coat, and I headed for the back door. And then I thought, I'm going to go see who's sitting on the front porch. So I looked through the front door, and here are these two young women from my class sitting there, and they'd been there for maybe an hour and a half sitting out there talking. So I went out on the porch, and I said, are you trying to work up your courage to come in and talk to somebody? And they said, yes. And I said, well, what is it? And they said, well, we're going to fail your course. And I said, that's impossible. You can't fail my course. And why would you fail my course? And they said, it's because we didn't learn anything. And I said, this is a trick. I didn't know it was a trick at the time. But when I realized what had happened, it became a trick. And I've used it many times since, and it always works. I said, I couldn't believe that they didn't learn anything, right? And I said, look, you've been in my class all year long. You come to class, you participate, you took the midterms, you took the Christmas exam. What's the problem? And they said, well, we didn't learn anything. And I said, what didn't you learn? And they said, just everything. And I said, no, I got to know. Like, please help me. What didn't you learn? And they said, well, photosynthesis. And I said, okay, what didn't you learn about photosynthesis? And they said, just everything. And then I finally got them talking, and they talked as a group, like of two. They looked at each other and they said, well, it's in plants. And I said, yeah. And the other one said, well, but not all plants, because some plants eat dead stuff. And then the other one said, well, but it's not all the parts of plants, because not all the parts are green, and it's mainly leaves. And then the other one said, well, not just leaves, because sometimes plants have green stems too, and there's photosynthesis in the stems. It's just the green part. And I said, well, okay, yeah. And what didn't you learn? And they went, well, it's how it works. And I said, well, what about how it works? And they said, well, down inside the leaves, there's cells, right? And I said, yeah, right. And they said, and in the cells, there are these little green things. They're kind of, well, they're like little stacks of pita bread, except they're green. And I went, yeah? What about them? And they said, well, those pita breads, and they somehow zoomed the story up so that I could see these little pita breads. And then I could see they sliced them, and I could see that each one of them was hollow, but it was green. And then they kept zooming the story in closer and closer and closer until one of them started looking up in the sky while she was talking. And we could see these pita breads way, way up there, these green things. And then in the story, she zoomed these things right up. So they took up most of the sky, and you could see what she was talking about. And she said, and there's these molecules in there that are amazing. And I said, which ones? And they said, she said, well, chlorophyll. Chlorophyll. She said, chlorophyll is an amazing molecule. It looks kind of like a sperm. Like that. She said, it's got a big head on it, and then it's got a long tail. And I said, well, what didn't you learn about it? And she said, oh, just hold on. Because she wanted to tell me what she did know. And so she went through all this stuff and about the structure of chlorophyll molecules. And chlorophyll molecules have alternating single and double bonds between carbon atoms. And she said, and the other one said, well, then that's called a conjugated system. And then they said, well, yes, but the thing about a conjugated system is that it resonates. And what wavelength of light it resonates in depends on how many carbon atoms there are in this conjugated system. And I'm just kind of sitting here waiting for her to get to the part she doesn't know. And then she said, you know, and then there's all these other molecules in there too. And named some of them. And said some of them are stuck right in the membrane. And then she zoomed it up some more so we could see just this one chlorophyll molecule. And then she said, and then a photon of light comes from the sun, and it just comes winging in like that, and it comes in through the atmosphere, and it comes down and whoop, and it goes through the surface of the leaf and down inside that cell, and sometimes it just zips right on through. But if it hits that chlorophyll molecule, the chlorophyll molecule starts shaking like that, and then it kicks off an electron or a pair of electrons, and she went through all this whole big bucket brigade of what happens to the electron and how a sugar molecule gets formed, and then they just stopped, and it was silent. And I'm standing out there waiting for her to tell me what she didn't learn. And I said, well, but what didn't you learn? And she said, well, you keep talking about energy. And the physics teacher talks about energy. And the chemistry teacher talks about energy. And everybody talks about energy. Even the sociology teacher talks about energy. But what is it? And they were going to flunk my class. They weren't going to come to the class because they didn't know what energy was. And I thought about it. And I scratched my head. And I thought, well, I don't know what it is either. And I said, I don't know anybody that does either. I don't know anybody that knows what energy is. And they said, well, we're still not going to come to your class because we don't know anything. And I said, how about this? How about if you came to the exam anyway, and if I asked you something that you didn't know, you just make it up. And they looked at me like that. And they're like, you can't do that. This is science. And that's the punchline of that story. But the punchline may not be clear to you yet unless you understand that what we do as scientists is make stuff up. That's our job. And they didn't get it. And so I realized that my whole first year of teaching at UBC failed on some really important counts. One count was those two women thought that they hadn't learned anything because they didn't know what energy was. Another one was they didn't have a clue what science is. They didn't know scientists live in a space of ignorance. And we're like moths to the flame of ignorance. We can't avoid getting in contact with what we don't know. That's what fascinates us. That's what drives us. And my students didn't understand that. So I, you know, that kind of entered into how I thought about education and how I did things in the classroom. But again, it was all just me and my students. Really nice things happened. Then we got a new dean. But that was 1990. Not very long ago, Barry, sitting right there. Now, this, he denies this, but he's not up here talking, so I get to tell it my way, the same way I always tell this story. See, because there's a program called Arts One on this campus that must be about 40 now, because it was about 30-something then. And it's a great program. It's interdisciplinary program in humanities. The whole team of professors get together, and they make up something like Aboriginal notions of whatever. And they spend a whole year with first-year students just digging into that issue from all the different points of view in the humanities. And Barry said, I want one too. So he commissioned a study. It took us 2 years. George Spiegelman back there was the chair of it. And then there were four others of us. And we spent the whole first year scrapping and fighting and arguing with each other from our disciplinary points of view. Now, I don't know, think Bob Thompson's here, but I'm going to tell a story anyway. He didn't do what Khrushchev did, but he darn near took his shoe off and pounded on the table. He used his fist, and he said, these are again my words, but he said, the chemistry component of the Science 1 curriculum will be exactly and completely the chemistry component of the existing chemistry courses at present, delivered in the same way, in the same sequence, and by the same people. And then we'll talk about integration. Well, it took us a whole year. See, because it wasn't just Tom, it wasn't just Bob, it was me too. I was just as bad. Because I had on my biologist hat, my biologist glasses, and I went into the meeting defending my disciplinary way of thinking about things. And Leah Keshet came in as a mathematician, Luis Sobrino came in as a physicist, and Bob Thompson was there as a chemist. And we were there talking about how we could develop something that was integrated and that was all of science and not just all the four separate core science disciplines. And sometime toward the end of that year, we realized that we sort of liked coming to those meetings because it was so much fun talking with each other. We ate our lunch together, and it was kind of fun arguing. And we got the idea gradually that maybe what we needed to do was think not just about how to deliver the material, what we think of as content, what I call as a biologist frog gut, right? The knee bone and the thigh bone and all that stuff that you memorize and say back on a test. But we needed to think about the community. We needed to think about how we thought about things. And we needed to have some way of making it be apparent to students how we were thinking about things, and apparent to students the differences in how we thought about things. In other words, if I could come in as a biologist and actually be a biologist there in public, while Luis Sobrino was being a physicist, and if we could interact with each other in front of the students and invite the students to interact with us, the students wouldn't know what hat to put on. Or maybe they could put on their physicist hat and then switch over to the biologist hat, put their chemistry hat on, and so on. Anyway, that's sort of what we came up with. And then we called it Science One, and we prepared a report, and Barry looked at the report, and he said, okay, well, do it then. And how about you four do it? And so the four of the members of that team were the first teaching team in Science One. Now, I need to stop right now because I've been telling the story as if it could be told just about faculty. And obviously can't be told without students. But it also can't be told without referring to the people that actually make it happen. And that's people called sessional lecturers. They're people who are pretty poorly paid. They have no job security. They work their butts off. And in Science One, they make it happen. In Coordinated Sciences Program, they make it happen. In Integrated Sciences Program, they make it happen. In other programs, graduate students, in a lot of ways, make it happen. And so one of the things that I want everybody to think about is I want us all to think about the cost to the system that we're trying to make work for students when we have polarization, when we have competition, when we have a breakdown of the constructive communication that can lead to really powerful growth. We just came out of a really destructive strike, and we're going to be living with the consequences of that for quite a long time. So that's just something that I have in my mind that we're going to have to deal with in the future. Somehow, we're going to have to bring everybody who's essential for these things to work to a level of respect and security that allows them to function really well. So in Science One, the idea is that you get a group of students, and these are all science keeners. They really love science. They've taken a lot of science in high school. Most of them, many of them, have taken 12th grade biology, chemistry, physics, and math. The ones that haven't had all four of those haven't had biology. But they really love science. Then you got professors from the four disciplines all there together in the classroom. And you've got three more PhDs in the room, two sessional lectures and a director. And these now it's 72 students. And the students are caught in a crossfire of disciplinary points of view. And so what happens is that one of us will get up and we'll start talking about our discipline. And we do what teachers always do. They put on their teacher hat, they get started, and they just roll. And they start saying whatever it is they got to say, which is traditionally, it's stuff to memorize. But for the other faculty sitting there, all of them research scientists, they have an awful hard time listening to that. Because it just doesn't make much sense. Teachers tell lies. Well, we call it simplification. But really, what they are a lot of times is just bald-faced lies. And we defend it, and we say, well, they're not ready to understand the real thing. They can understand it next year or the year after or the year after that. We don't tend to tell the truth. But, boy, it gets hot in there sometimes. And when I lie, and Luis Sobrino's in the room, or Jim Carolyn's in the room, you can't get away with it. And so the next story I want to tell is sometime in September of the first year of Science One, I was introducing a unit on energetics. And in 1 hour, I wanted to paint a picture of the entire biosphere in terms of energy. I wanted students to have a picture in their mind of a system that runs on sunlight. And I wanted them to see about energy transformations occurring at all levels of organization, from ecological levels on down through individual physiological levels, cellular and subcellular levels. And I was just on my horse, and I was just going like this, doing my thing that I'd done many times before. Luis Sobrino stood up, and he put his hand up. We never did that. We weren't formal in Science One. We just butted in. But he stood up and he put his hand up and he waited for me to call on him. And I said, Luis. And he very formally said, we've been listening to you, my colleague Dr. Thompson and I from the Department of Chemistry. And frankly, we're having a very difficult time understanding how you can even think about these things except in the context of thermodynamics. And I got really quiet, and he invited me to defend myself, which I promptly tried to do. And after about 3 or 4 minutes of trying to defend this thermodynamic-less presentation of energy, I realized he's right. So I had to stop, and I had to say, Luis, you're right. You're absolutely right. But I don't know how to do that on my own. I need help from you. And he said, and you need help from Bob Thompson here too. And I said, yes, I do. I need help from anybody that can help me bring biology into the context of physics and chemistry. And so they were all too happy to help. And I needed their help. The students needed their help. And the fact is that, for example, the photosynthesis that we were able to do that year was far, far deeper and clearer for the students than it had ever been with me alone. And the reason was it was more complete. It made more kinds of sense, even from a biological point of view, that these other points of view were mixed in with it. And we did things like trying to give, remember, Mark, we tried to give the first midterm, when would that have been? Juliet, early October or something, the first midterm, and we said, okay, we're going to not have any subjects in our midterm. We're just going to have a Science 1 midterm. Oh, they couldn't deal with it. They just couldn't deal with it. So we had to call the midterms biology, chemistry, math, and physics. But Luis Sobrino had questions about lions and antelope in the Serengeti on his physics exam, and they said, but this is supposed to be physics. And he said, well, it is physics. They're moving particles, aren't they? You can use the same calculus that you use on other moving particles, so quit complaining. So they said, okay, I guess it's physics. And so we did things like that. And students got a little bit confused sometimes. But the thing was, I think partly because they saw the faculty interacting with each other so actively, sometimes aggressively, they got used to interacting. And the key thing was they got used to speaking in public about their own ignorance, because that's what we had to do. We had to do what we do in our science, which is begin from what we don't know and go from there. The students became comfortable, well, more comfortable than they had been before, talking about their ignorance. And then when those students hit second year, they were amazing, because they could sit in a room like this full of second-year students, and the prof's up here writing on the overhead or whatever prof's do in rooms like this, just going like crazy, and they never get any questions. Hand goes up, doesn't even see him because nobody ever asks any questions. They go, excuse me. And he looks up. And they said, yes. And so they'd ask questions, and they'd ask questions about all kinds of things. They'd say things like, well, 5 minutes ago you said this, and just now you said this, and I don't see how those two things go together. Just fantastic kind of question. Because almost always when that happens, it's we forgot to say something, or we said it wrong. And the Science 1 students were noticing that. And the faculty were coming to us, and they said, what are you doing in there? And we said, well, we're not quite sure what we're doing in there. But we know what our students are doing in your class. And, I mean, Linda Matsuchi, who was a fairly new teacher, and she taught one of those big, ugly second-year classes, came and she said, but those students are getting closer and closer and closer to the part that I don't know. And I said, that's fantastic, Linda. Isn't that fantastic? And she said, no. And she said, well, what am I going to do when they get there? And I said, well, I don't know. You better figure out, though, because I'm whipping those kids up with a stick. And she figured it out. Everybody figures it out sooner or later. And it's more fun that way. It's a lot more fun because it pushes the boundaries and it keeps the students close to their own boundaries. Now, in the first year, it was really difficult for those in the Science 1 graduates who were in second year, because the other students were trying to get them to shut up. Shut up so I can take notes. Because this is about memorizing, right? You got to get it all down so you can suck it in and spit it back out again. That's the name of the game. But for those students who somehow got their minds warped the year before, it wasn't about that. It was about understanding. And we also noticed something else during that first year of Science 1, and I suppose it still happens. The ones that are living in the dorm, they come and tell us, they say, well, you know, people are asking us all kinds of questions because they're getting ready for their midterms too in their other courses. And they'd show us, and we say, and they'd show us something and want some help with it. And we say, well, we didn't study that. But what is it? And so they'd look at it and fairly quickly make sense of it. And then they'd say something that helped the other student. And the other student said thank you and went away. And then the Science 1 student understood something about what we didn't teach them. And then they'd come back and tell us, oh, you know, I learned a neat thing. How'd you learn that? Well, I learned it helping another student learn it. Well, teachers all know that. Teachers all know that. That's how we learn things. So help somebody else learn it, and you got it. So that's Science 1. And Science 1 is 10 now, isn't it? It's just coming up to finals in the 10th year. It's wildly successful in a lot of different ways. But it's wildly successful for a fairly small group of students, 72. It's expensive because it's got all those faculty. And in the third year of Science 1, we realized Barry was going to pull the rug out from under us if we didn't start producing some benefit for more students than just those 72, because it's an expensive program, and he had to defend it against people that thought we were stealing their money, which we were. And so we came up with what we call the Coordinated Sciences Program. And Coordinated Sciences Program is a very simple thing. It's one-click registration. So they sign up for CSP. And what that means is the same group of students go through their four science classes together as a cohort. That's the only difference, except that the four faculty meet once a week to talk to each other about how to present and how they can cooperate in presentation. And that's it. But what happens in Coordinated Sciences Program is similar to what happens in Science 1. A community develops. They become comfortable talking with each other. They become comfortable exposing their ignorance in public. They become comfortable talking with small groups of students about things they only partially understand. And we know now that students talking with other students is number one most important thing. It's much more important than talking at them. Talk at them a little bit, just to do what I call stir up some trouble. Then you say, get in your groups, see if you can clarify this situation. They start talking with each other. And the more time they spend together, the more comfortable they are talking with each other, and the more comfortable they are exposing the parts that they don't know with each other, and the more comfortable they are cooperating rather than competing with each other, and the faster they learn. Coordinated Sciences Program is pretty darn successful too. Even though Coordinated Sciences Program, now you may call me a liar over this, Mark, but Coordinated Sciences Program don't tend to be the science keeners that took all that science in high school. And there are high-performing students, low-performing students, and middle-performing students that prefer a one-click registration and find themselves in Coordinated Sciences Program. But it works, and like I say, it's a very simple thing. Based on an integration of material across the disciplines, based on a sense of community that develops among the students and between the students and the faculty, and based on what you could think of as truth-telling. That is an embracing of ignorance as a basis for moving into understanding. So that's the Coordinated Sciences Program. Long about that same time, we started thinking about how to bring this to more students and at other levels. And the idea came along of having whole courses that were what we call duets between just two disciplines. Maybe we could have courses at the higher levels that crossed disciplinary boundaries. Maybe that would be a good thing. Maybe it could bring a kind of depth that wasn't available normally. And so we invented the Integrated Sciences program. And that's a two-year degree program that students apply for after their second year. And they have to apply with a vision statement of their life and their education. And they have to embrace breadth in that vision statement. It has to articulate a vision of more than one discipline. And they have to identify two different disciplines that they intend to take all the way to the fourth year level and build a bridge between for some reason that has to do with their life. So one example in the first year, and this is the most far out example that's happened in that program, this student wanted to be a science journalist, she argued in this essay, and she said, but there's no way to become a science journalist, even though there are science journalists, but she said there's no way to do that in institutions because you have to either be a scientist or a journalist. In fact, they won't even let me take writing courses if I'm a scientist because I can't get in. So she proposed to go as deep as she could in one science discipline, and she picked oceanography because that was her love. And she needed to take courses in the English department, courses in creative writing, courses in the journalism school, technical writing courses in engineering. Anywhere she could find things about writing, that's what she said, I need to take. So they make up their own curriculum for 2 years. And they also take these special integrated courses. I have been teaching one, for example, with an atmospheric physicist, and the name of the course is The Sizes of Things. The Sizes of Things. And it's all about what difference it makes, what size things are. On one level, that's very simple. But on another level, we bring in some fairly powerful mathematical tools to allow people to explore relationships across vast ranges of scale. And then we turn those students loose into all the disciplines, not just science disciplines, to explore for these scaling relationships. Again, it's a very successful program. Some of the students are very high performers when they come in. Some are not, though. Some have a history of mediocre performance. They come into Integrated Sciences program and something happens. They become, as George Spiegelman said, the first day of the first course of that program, he said he'd like the program to make them smarter. Well, we didn't know what that meant. But it does make them smarter. It makes them more attentive to things that make a difference. It makes them more willing to use their intelligence to create knowledge for themselves. And it makes them more willing and more able to help each other learn in a problem situation. That's Integrated Sciences program. Now, all three of those programs are based on the same set of simple ideas. Integration across disciplines. That doesn't mean squeezing the discipline out and ending up with a kind of mush, which is kind of what I was thinking about when we started planning. But that's not the idea, because the disciplines are still strong and discrete. Jim Carolyn is still a physicist, and I can't stop him from being a physicist. He insists on looking at things through the lenses of a physicist. And he insists on interacting with me as a physicist. And there's a lot of power in that idea of integration across disciplines. But that same example also illustrates interaction among the individuals interactive engagement, we call it. I already talked about it with respect to the students. And we know from physics undergraduate education that interactive engagement among students roughly doubles the conceptual understanding of Newtonian mechanics relative to other courses in which the professor just stands there and talks at them. It's kind of a no-brainer when you think about how we do things in the real world. But that's not how we do things in here. And that's changing. So interaction is the second thing. And then the third thing is an amalgam. It's community. And it really does feel like a community. And those things work in a lot of ways. Now, I need to say that we don't really understand in a rigorous way what is it about those things that work. For example, there's a very, very good study of first-year physics courses, and that's the one that concluded that conceptual understanding of Newtonian mechanics is roughly doubled in courses in which students have a significant opportunity to talk with each other. They could do that in little breakout groups in lecture, they could do it in lab, they could do it in tutorials or whatever. It doesn't seem to matter, but it has a dramatic effect. But what we don't know is how much interactive engagement is required. In Science 1, there could be more, but there's quite a bit. In coordinated sciences, there's a lot of it. In integrated sciences, there are a lot of it. But how much do we need? We don't know. We don't know how much interactive engagement among faculty is required. I believe that it's very important. But I believe that for personal reasons, in addition to the other reasons that I have. I believe it because it was such a powerful thing for me when Luis Sobrino stuck up his hand and asked me to defend myself about something I couldn't defend myself about. And I tried. So we don't know that. We, as teachers, at every level and in every kind of institution, we complain about class size. We don't know, we don't understand how group size influences the quality of education. We all say it does, and we nod, yes, but we don't know. And as we become more skilled in this kind of context, it becomes more possible for us to ask students to conduct interactive engagement exercises, even in a room like this. And the amazing thing is they do. You sneak up on them, and they're talking about what you asked them to talk about. It's incredible. But we don't understand. There are lots and lots and lots of things that we're ignorant about how people learn. And so I started out talking about what it was like when I first got here, which is we hired you for your teaching, but we'll fire you for your research. I went through 25 years of just barely scraping through. Barely scraping through tenure and promotion for the first time, being rejected twice for promotion after that based on research. My research was fine, I just didn't do as much of it as most other people did. And things are changing. People are becoming recognized not just for their research, but also for their work with students. That's becoming part of the system. People are beginning to get promotion, partly on the basis of their teaching. But that's just starting. It's just starting, and we don't understand yet how to build a community of professional scholars that has a full range of people, from people who concentrate mainly on their research and do a little bit of teaching, and people who concentrate mainly on teaching and do some research. There are models for that kind of community. Simon Fraser is trying parts of it. UBC is trying some things in other ways. But we have lots of questions. And what I'd like to do now, rather than me continue to talk about these programs, is just to stop and see if you have any questions, either about what I've said or about anything else that you think is related. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll take questions, Lynn. Oh, yes.
I'm curious what balance you have found to work between the two of those in different contexts.
Yeah. So Lynn took my dichotomy between professing and listening, essentially, and asked me to talk about a balance. Yes, professing is important. But it's important in a different way, I think, than we've tended to think. We tend to think of professing as a transfer of information. And that's usually how we conduct it. And the students sit there and they write like crazy. And as Hake's study of the physics students showed, that sort of works, but sort of doesn't. For me as a student, professing did a lot. It did a lot when a professor would get to a place where he or she didn't really understand quite enough, and I get to see him thinking and not just talking. When they heard a question, and they had to think about the answer. Or when they told a story about their own lives. When they told a story about some research that they tried to do and then failed and failed and then succeeded. That was really inspiring to me. All kinds of things like that, in which a professor was professing not just the material, but a way of looking at the material, a way of approaching working with the material, a way of handling the frustration of having different ways of interpreting the same material and not being able to tell which one is the correct way. All of those things inspired me enormously. And they also inspired me to read. And I need to tell a story about Barry. I forgot to tell that story. Oh, I'm sorry. And this is against my version, my story. But in the third year of Science One, Barry McBride, the dean of science then, had to go off someplace and brag about Science One. And that's what we do in academic. We go someplace else and brag about things. Well, he didn't know anything about Science One, but he still had to go off and brag about it. So that meant he had to come to class. And he came, and he sat right in the middle of the room. Mark was there. Well, you, Jim, was there. Juliet was there. And he sat right there. And it was a Wednesday. And on Wednesdays, we had 4 hours of class. And then we had our planning meeting after. And so Barry's sitting there, and I won't talk about the other 3 hours, but during my hour, it was bedlam. I'd get up and profess for about maybe 4 or 5 minutes to produce some kind of problem that needed thought, and then the students started working on it, and I'd just step aside. And sometimes the students would come up right on the board, say, "That's not right! Well, you come up and do it then." So that somebody else would come up and erase it and do it again, and I'm just sitting there, and then every once in a while I'd come in and say a little bit more, just to stir it up a little bit more, and then it just went sort of by itself. And Barry's sitting there like this, turning around, listening to all these comments that students are making. So we got all finished, and we went into our planning meeting, and because Barry was there, we got to have sushi that day. And so we're sitting there, and he's a good listener. He just sat there. And we were talking with each other. And then I popped off this one-liner to one of my colleagues. Well, I don't teach him very much. And Barry sat up, and boy, you sure don't. And I thought, alpha male attack. That's an alpha male attack for sure. I'm a behavioral ecologist. I know about alpha males. You only got two choices when an alpha male attacks you. You either roll over on your belly and present your soft underbelly like that and say, you know, rip out my guts. I'm ready to die. And they usually don't. Or you bite them back. So I sat up and I said, that's right, Barry, I sure don't. But did you notice the quality of the discussion in there today? And he said, yes, that was remarkable. And they even sounded like they knew something. And I said, that's because they did. And he said, well, how could they know something if you didn't teach them? And I said, because they read, that's why. Dean of Science, provost of a major research university in North America, quote, students won't read. Students won't read. Well, that's common knowledge. But it wasn't true in this case. And I said, they will if you don't teach them anything. But it isn't enough just to not teach them. They got to know that you're going to hold them responsible for the stuff you don't teach them. That works. That really works. And if you don't tell them what's going to be on the test, I mean, they always want to know what's on the test, right? What do we have to know for the test? I discovered something a long time ago that just kills that. I've said exactly the same thing. I don't know when I started saying it, a long time before Science won. But they'd ask me, what do we have to know for the test? And I'd say, well, that just depends. And they'd be like, just depends. Like, you know, I want certainty. And you're telling me it just depends. Well, what does it depend on? I said, well, it depends on whether you're going up for a 51 or a 91 in here. And they always say, in exactly the same words, they always say, a 91, of course. And I say, well, what do you mean, of course? You don't have to get a 91 in here. You don't even have to go to university. You can dig ditches if you want. And they said, well, but I've got to get to medical school, and I got to have a 91. And I say, well, if you're going for a 91, I'm sorry. I can't tell you what's on the test. I mean, it is really hard to get a 91 in here. I mean, it's just not a matter of me listing off things you need to know. I have to use professional standards to judge you. And there's no stopping rule. I mean, there's a whole library full of stuff you might want to know. And besides, if you're going for a 91, you got to be able to express yourself so clearly that I can't find anything wrong in what you say on the test. And they say, okay, that's what I thought you'd say. And they never say 51. Sometimes they say, well, I want to make sure I pass. And I'd say, well, I wouldn't go for a 51, though, if I were you. I'd say maybe put a little, you know, margin in there. Maybe go for 58 or something. But it's not too easy. It's not too hard to pass this class if that's all you're going for. But there's something in that, and it has to do with Lynn's question, that the function, one of the really good functions of professing is to confuse the students in particular ways that require them to do something with the information and to click it into some kind of place that wouldn't be there if they didn't do it themselves. So, any other questions? Yeah.
I'm really intrigued with what you say in terms of integration and community building. And I'm wondering to what extent you find yourself being dragged into dealing with helping people become a community and how they are.
Yeah. Okay, so the question is, how much of our effort is about community building as opposed to?
No. The question is, as soon as you open the door,
yeah,
to trying to create a community,
yeah,
you go way beyond the discipline.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You get into ethics, and you get into how we are in terms of respect for each other, you get into diversity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, that's a very important question. She said, once you open the door to community, you're opening the door to something much bigger than what I've been talking about here. You're opening the door, on the first level, to the fact that science is a deeply cultural phenomenon, but also that the culture of science is embedded in culture as a whole. How much of our time and effort, or how much of the significant things that happen are have to do with deeply cultural things like ethics? And I'd say considerable. In Science One now, is it more now than it was at the beginning? Mark's been there all 10 years. Okay. Yeah. Now, let me ask you a question, Mark. Can everybody hear Mark?
No.
No, so you get a scream. I could say that competed with the learning of science, or I could wonder whether it enhance the learning of science. What can you say about that?
I think when we didn't understand that we were building a community,
yeah,
we were very focused on what students were learning. We spent a lot of time in the first maybe 3 to 5 years of the program trying to come up with numbers to compare our students to the mainstream.
Yeah. Does that address it? Yeah. And I even remember, like, you know, Luis Sobrino had a hero. He's a physicist. And he had this hero named Galileo. And he had stories about Galileo that I just loved. And one of the stories was about him sitting in a coffee house in Venice, when they were building Venice and driving piles. And they didn't have these big power pile drivers like they have now. They had big rocks and pulleys, and it took them a long time to lift up a rock. And in Luis's story, Galileo's sitting there, you know, drinking his coffee all morning while they lift up this rock, and then they pull a pin and a rock falls down, and Galileo noticed that how far the pile went down depended on how far the rock had gone up. And according to Luis, that was a big thing for Galileo because he started thinking about momentum. Well, he was also sitting in a coffee house, right? He wasn't just looking at a book. He wasn't just making calculations. He was sitting in a coffee house. Now, whether he actually sat in a coffee house, I don't know. But I got the feeling from that that Galileo was a real human being. And that's important. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's really important. She said I was talking about questions that I call real questions. That is a question that that displays the questioner's ignorance. But she said many of the questions that she's heard from students or other people are not real questions. Eh? So I do explicit work with students to get them to see, for example, and in fact, I turn them loose and say, go around. It's not going to do any good to listen to yourself. Listen to your friends and come back and tell me what proportion of all the utterances that you hear in the week are questions. Tell me, though, before you go, what those numbers are going to be. Well, they always guess low. And they come back and they say, my God, people ask a lot of questions. Eh? But most of them aren't real questions. So that's the first distinction between questions and real questions. And they come to realize that there's something special about the kind of question that exposes the questioner's ignorance. And then there's a second distinction that I make between real questions and powerful questions. Powerful questions are questions that point to their own answer. They program the questioner to appreciate an answer. And often, they allow the questioner to realize that the answer is right there, right in the middle of asking the question. So, yeah, explicit work with all kinds of things like that, including listening. So Doe and I, in our Sizes of Things class, we had tutorials, and there was this one group of students, five students, really, really good students. But the problem was there was five talkers and no listeners in that class. And they were high-performing students in regular classes, and they were cruising for a bruising in our class because they couldn't produce anything as a group. And they are frustrated with each other. They got angry with each other. They'd come complain to us because the other ones wouldn't listen. And we'd say, well, you know, it's the way it goes sometimes. And but one day on the way to class, to the lecture part of the class, I thought, I'm going to try something. So I said to Doe, I want to start class today. It's okay? And he said, yeah, sure, fine. So I said, okay, now, I want to hear some bragging in here. I want to hear some bragging. Does any team have something to brag about? Has anybody made a breakthrough? Has anybody made some important discovery? Two hands from that group went up immediately. Immediately. And I said, yes. And they said, well, we've discovered since the last tutorial that it's important to listen. And the whole class cheered. Because they knew. So all kinds of things like that. Yeah. Well, a question is just a thing that has a question mark after it, or has an inflection if you speak it. It's just something that formally qualifies as a question. And I could ask, Is it a dark and stormy night tonight? And just to make conversation. And you'd know I was a big fat liar. Because I know very well it's a dark and stormy night tonight. And a lot of the questions that we hear from students, as she said, are opportunities, they function as opportunities to brag about knowledge rather than reveal ignorance. So they'll ask some question that they already know the answer to. Real question is a question from a person who doesn't know the answer to it. So if I say to Luis Sobrino, Luis, what is energy? Which I heard a student do one time. And he said, I don't know. I don't have any idea what energy is. He said, and as a physicist, I don't care. I just don't care what energy is. All I care about is how to measure it. And all I care about is what it can do. And the student is just going nuts. Like, how can you even talk about it if you don't know what it is? He said, I don't know what anything is. I don't know what anything is. All I know about is what I can measure. Well, that's Luis. But does that help? Okay. What else? Yeah. Yeah.
Overall integration type model. So I'm wondering what wasn't happening when they were interacting with their previous classroom.
Well, yeah, it's hard to answer that in general because there are different lab courses. So here at UBC, the physics first year lab course or lab program is really, really good. And Mark, where's Mark go? Mark was really important in getting the first year physics lab program to be very, very good at getting students to understand error, the importance of error in measurement, the importance of error in estimation. I don't know if they talked about it, but they did things that confronted that issue of error. The chemistry lab program is very good at getting students to understand about procedures, about safety, and things like that. And the biology lab program is very good at experimental design, developing research programs, and things like that. It's an excellent question. I think that the discussion, at least if I go back to my own experience as an undergrad, in most of my lab courses, the discussion was not about the deeper aspect of the material. It was about what we had to do to finish our lab report. And that helps, but I don't think it helps as much as really confronting the harder stuff. And so that's what we added. Yeah. Well, at first, I lived in separate worlds. I was ashamed of my art, and I was ashamed of my science. And I tried to keep them separate. And one year, I went to a lot of Christmas parties. And one night, I would come as my friend, the scientist, and there'd be a bunch of artists. And I'd find out that I was kind of a pariah because I was cold and heartless, and I computed my whole entire life. And I was confronting the prejudices of artists against scientists. And then the very next night, I would be my friend, the artist, at another kind of party. And I'd find out that I was a flake, right? I couldn't be trusted to do anything, and I didn't have any rigor in my life. And so it was really hard for me to keep these things apart. And then I actually literally had a coming out as an artist in the big lecture hall in the biology building. And I shared my art. And when I started doing that, I started to discover really important, strong interactions between those. For example, in my science, I had been getting pretty good at visualizing relationships, quantitative relationships between things. I could imagine graphs, for example. Or I could imagine graphs that were three-dimensional graphs. Or I could imagine three-dimensional graphs that moved over time to describe some things about how hummingbirds interact in mountain meadows in the summertime. Well, that facility for imagining the forms of relationships was really, really handy to me in imagining form and developing form. So there were benefits that flowed toward art. Another kind of benefit that flowed toward art was technical, that I was comfortable thinking about materials. I was comfortable thinking about, for example, a piece of steel that's spinning at 10,000 RPM with diamonds on the outside of it. And if it's not balanced, it shakes. And if it shakes, it breaks the rock. It's not a hard thing, but I could think about it, and I could think about what to do about it. I could think about the strengths of the materials that I was working with. But benefits flowed the other direction too. As I became more passionate about developing three-dimensional forms in stone and wood, I became more free to imagine farther in my science than I had before. To imagine, and also to imagine how hummingbirds imagine form. And through my interest in sculpting, I discovered a very rich literature in psychophysics. It's the study of perception. And so I went into it to understand some things about how we perceive three-dimensional form in an aesthetic context. But I discovered things in that literature that were important in the hummingbird work. And we began to open up avenues of hummingbird research that came from that psychophysical literature. So it was pretty rich. There's still competition for time, right? Because there's only 36 or 37 hours a day. Yeah. Well, I haven't been in science once since 1976, so I can't say very... I mean, 1996. I can't say much about how the entering students have changed in that program. I think students are getting more comfortable in working with each other. They're more comfortable with the idea of cooperation, although their own career aims just fly in the face of cooperation. Well, I said before, I always need to work on that. If, for example, I need to talk about the power of listening to draw really clear, powerful speaking out of people. And that sounds kind of crazy when they first hear it. But once they start to experience what happens when they listen really carefully to somebody, the other person gets smarter. I mean, it's quite amazing. Crystal, when did you come in? You don't want me to say your, do you? Yes, years are different. And so what she's asking is, sometimes do you get a dud class? And you get hard classes. Your year of CSP was easy. And it was easy because of you. You can't shut her up. And she's always thinking about things. And her team became an exemplar for other teams. And it just spread like it was infectious. So that was a really good year. And there are hard years, but there haven't been any years that haven't really worked. It's just sometimes it happens later. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it's going to happen, and then it starts to happen. But the really neat thing about learning trajectories that are this kind, right, that you start off and it feels like it's slow because you're investing in group process and you're investing in all kinds of things, and then it just speeds up and speeds up and speeds up, and it doesn't seem to make as much difference in that kind of environment, that some classes start slower. Yeah. Well, I don't see those as in opposition to each other. I think it's very important for us to reveal our own lives. I emphasized our own ignorance, but not just that. Stories, sure. Stories from our own research, stories from our own lives as students, all very important. But the most important thing is using that to spin it back on them. Oh, yeah. And I don't think it can work unless it gets spun back onto them as individuals.
Sorry to have to an end. This is wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Guest.
Thank you.
Guess who we're going to get to thank you?
Well, he's going to get even with me?
He's going to be able to get his own back here. He's going to have the final word, not only for tonight, but for this session of the Vancouver Institute. The Vice President and Provost, Barry McBride.
Thanks, Pat. And I'm not going to try and defend myself, Lee. I'll tell some stories in a minute, though. You can see what an incredibly fortunate choice it was way back in 1990 when we made the decision to try to do something different. And what a group it was, with George, with Lee, with Lewis, and we kept Bob Thompson in there to keep you guys straight, otherwise this thing would have gone up and who knows where it would have ended up. That was an interesting time. There was a great deal of criticism of how research-intensive universities viewed teaching. And so one was operating, as Lee said, against a... There was a huge inertia to moving any part of this agenda forward. And I think it was fortunate that they hit on something as exciting as they did, and then were able to pull it off so well. Because I can tell you from my own point of view, what I was looking for was something that in itself was very important and good, but would act as a catalyst for change. And Lee talked about a number of programs that have come from this, and this has been a tremendous catalyst for change. But not only within the Faculty of Science, but within the university as a whole. It's a very, very different environment when one looks at teaching. So it was a beachhead for change. I can tell you it wasn't easy, and Lee, I don't know if you remember, and the program and George and presented this, and people thought it was just fantastic, and the heads all said, yes, it's what a great program that is. But don't you start that if you take one nickel out of my budget. And so that was always was the battle in those days. There's a fellow who comments on education and teaching and its importance in a research university. It's a Frank Rhodes, who I have who's a very articulate individual, president of Cornell University for many years. He's retired now, but there's a particular paragraph that I want to I'm going to quote from one of his papers that I think captures so much of. I didn't realize it at the time what we were trying to do, but and what you were accomplishing. And then, let me just quote. He's talking about the undergraduate curriculums and the changes that must take place. And he says, we must recapture the curriculum so that it excites rather than exhausts, encourages rather than engorges, and nurtures an outward-looking, generous, and cooperative spirit rather than one of narrow self-preoccupation. And I thought so much of what you talked about and what is the essence and what comes out of came out of Science One and the Integrated Science Program is captured in that statement. As you've heard, Lee is a sculptor. And if you get a chance to see his work, it's absolutely marvelous. And Lee and I are having a conversation about how best we could use this incredible talent we've got here to move the learning agenda forward, how Lee could impart some of the things that you've heard today to our faculty. And it wasn't a coffee house in Venice that we were meeting in, but it was a garage on Windsor Street between 37th and 36th, is that right? And that's Lee's studio. And it was as much energy, excitement, and animation as you saw here tonight as he talked to me about the sculpting he does and the thinking that goes into it and the ignorance that is a part of the process as this thing takes shape. And it was a wonderful experience. But Jim, you failed, because I don't think this guy understands Newtonian mechanics at all. I was so worried about my toes as he hefted this big stuff around that it's amazing. But anyway, I think you've seen tonight the commitment, the energy, the dedication, and the vision of somebody who is really making a difference in teaching, not just here at UBC, but internationally. And I'd like you to join me in thanking Lee for a very entertaining evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice job, guys. Wonderful.